This episode of the Tech Central podcast is brought to you by Pinnacle, Africa's top ICT distribution business, delivering the exceptional every time. I'm Duncan McLeod and you're listening to the Tech Central podcast. I'm super excited about this next interview. I'm going to call with Nick Haralambos, entrepreneur and newly published author. Nick has a warts and all tell-all book called Do, Fail, Learn, Repeat, The Truth Behind Building Businesses. It's about the ups and I think it's fair to say, reading the book, the many downs of life as an entrepreneur. Nick, welcome to the podcast. It's great to have you here today.
Thanks, Duncan. Good to be talking.
So we are recording the show live today. If you have any questions for Nick, please do send through a WhatsApp, preferably as a voice note. The number to use is 071-999-1111. That's 071-999-1111. First of all, Nick, why write this book? We all know there's not much money in book publishing in South Africa, so why do it?
I think if you're an author or a budding writer and you think you're going to get rich by writing a bestseller, you can think again. For me, I have been a writer since I was little. I've been writing since I could write. And writing a book has always been something I wanted to do. I never really knew what to write about. I've tried to write many books since the age of about 14 and failed dismally. So I've been building things since about 16. And as an entrepreneur, you sort of realize that lots of people talk about how to be rich, how to be successful, how to hack your life, how to be amazing, and all the brilliant work that they do. And very rarely do I hear authentic tellings of the pain that entrepreneurs go through. Because once you've reached the point of success, all you really do is talk about the success. Very few people are retrospective and go, holy crap, that was hard. So I decided that I wanted to read a book about failure, so I should write a book about failure.
Yeah, and it's certainly very honest in its approach. You go into a great deal of detail about the difficulties of being an entrepreneur and some of the challenges that you faced. So, Nick, I think I first met you back in the mid-2000s. Perhaps it was a little bit earlier when we were both working at the Financial Mail. Yeah. You started your career in journalism. I had to have a chuckle about your take on the stifling corporate culture at what was then Avusa, now Tiso Blackstar. You went to work on for even bigger corporates, notably Vodacom. But I get the impression reading the book that you'll never go back into corporate again.
I'm always wary to say never, yeah, because you never know. I spent my time in corporates and it was good for what it was. And that was learning how to spend big budgets and endearing corporate culture and the meeting culture of corporates. But I think I'm what many people would term unemployable at this point in my career. And I think for good reason. And you know what, so be it. I do work with a lot of big businesses as on a consulting basis. But again, that's my terms and I get to leave whenever I feel like it. I don't see myself ever being fully employed, but I can't say never.
Sure. So as I discovered in the book, you were once an aspiring musician in your student days at Rhodes University. Is it fair to say that was one of your first major learnings when you realized your bandmates were not so keen on building this into a business?
Yes, definitely. I mean, and it's funny, a lot of the experiences that I write about in the book, I didn't know were going to be so poignant until much later. I mean, hindsight is always 20/20, I suppose. But being in the band, I had just left a very stifling Catholic school environment and I went to Rhodes, which is the complete opposite of a stifling Catholic school environment. And I'd been playing guitar since I was about 13, met up with a bunch of guys. And, you know, what started off as a fun side project, as is basically the story of my life, ended up being quite a serious band. We rehearsed three times a week, but it was never enough. And we gigged around the country, but we were never good enough. And we took it quite seriously until our final year when our lead singer – very intelligently decided to get a stable job and build his life after varsity instead of taking on the risky move of being a musician in South Africa. And that was really the end of the band. And I mean, look, there's some interesting lessons there. We were really bad at marketing, and we really were not good enough as a band to be massively famous. And that was kind of my first insight into hard work is a necessary requirement to success. It's not the only one, but it is necessary.
Yeah, yeah. You were also involved in the student newspaper. Tell us about that.
Yes. So from a very young age, I, for whatever reason, decided that I wanted to be a journalist for all my sins. And I like the biggest reason I can remember is I must have seen a movie about a war correspondent or something along those lines when I was a kid. And I just wanted to be a war correspondent. So my first year at Rhodes, I decided to study journalism. And it is, I don't know if it still is, but back then, and we're talking about 13 years ago, it was the top journalism degree in the country. So it was quite a brutal initiation, and they force you to do as much as you can outside of studying to kind of level up in the degree. You can't just study. You have to practically and proactively be a journalist from your very first year.
Yeah.
So I decided to join Captivate, or actually Activate. Captivate was the conference we ran. Activate, which is the student newspaper, and write for them, and ended up being the deputy editor there in my final year. And that was pretty good because it helped me understand that I wanted to actually go out and do something practical and not study for another year, which I did not do. I did not do my four-year BJourn to my parents' disappointment.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I thoroughly enjoyed the section in the book where you had to go and negotiate a discount from the dragon lady at the printers.
Yes.
And you were quite green around the gills, and got quite a quick lesson there in going into a negotiation and how you should be prepared or armed. You were given your marching orders quite quickly.
Yes. That was, without knowing it, my first experience of what a friend of mine, Rich Mulholland, would one day teach me is called BATNA, the best alternative to a negotiation. And I had absolutely no alternative to losing a negotiation with my printers because there is only one printer in Grahamstown.
Right.
So my negotiation went as follows. I'd like a discount, and they said no.
Yeah.
And that was the end of it. What I didn't realize is that if she lost my tiny newspaper, it would make no difference to her bottom line. But if I lost her agreement to print my newspaper, we would have no newspaper. And she was well aware of that, having 30 years of experience printing the Rhodes newspaper. So really simply, I learned that day that you've got to have leverage, good or bad. You need to be able to leverage in a negotiation.
Yeah, I suppose it's a bit like a consumer phoning up Eskom and asking for a discount.
Yeah, or Telkom. I mean, you got no chance. There's no incentive for them to help you.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay, and you were also involved in an early online startup, I think, while still at Rhodes, called StudentWire.
Yes. This I would say is probably the first formal business that I tried to build with two of my colleagues that I was studying with at the time.
Yep.
And we believed naively that everyone was like us and gave a crap about news at student level. And it's just fundamentally not true. Students back then were more interested in drinking and spending their money elsewhere than on news.
Yep.
So we decided that it was smart to get news aggregated from 10 campuses around the country and put it online at studentwire.net. And we started doing that, and it worked relatively well because obviously first and second year students who are in journalism are keen to have their articles published, but we very quickly realized that no one was reading the content.
Yeah.
We had lots of articles coming through. And then equally, we had a bit of a disagreement between the founders because I wanted it to be a for-profit product, and my two co-founders wanted it to be kind of an NPO where media was altruistic, and I still don't believe media is altruistic in any of its forms, and you need to make money to sustain journalism.
Yeah.
And that was my kind of first toe dipping into you need money to build a product. So myself and my co-founders amicably decided that I should take the project on and try and make a go of it, and they went on to bigger and better things.
All right. All right. So, Nick, tell us a bit about your upbringing. You go into it in quite a bit of detail in the book. You say you'd wished you'd learned more from your parents about entrepreneurship, particularly your dad, and life in general. But I get the impression you were a bit of a rebel when you were younger.
You know, it's funny. I intentionally tried to write it that way, but I was rebellious in my brain.
Yeah.
But I think externally, I knew what I learned what the rules were, and I followed them.
Okay.
Because, like, I realized that when you're a teenager, you don't actually control your existence. Your parents pay for everything, or you've got scholarships or bursaries or whatever. You don't really have the freedom to stay out late. You don't have the freedom to do much of anything, even to the point where I wasn't particularly involved in the choice of subjects that I got to study in grade 10. My parents thrust upon me science against my will and their judgment. So I learned very early on that the best way to get through being a teenager and having no freedom is to follow the rules and exploit them as best as you can.
Mm-hmm.
So I did that. I learned what the rules were and I played the game. I played rugby and got straight A's and was head prefect of my school, that good old Catholic school I mentioned earlier.
Yep.
But deep down, I really struggled with the idea of conformity. And as soon as I got the chance, i.e. going to Rhodes, I broke out as quickly as I could. So the upbringing was always interesting for me. I always preferred talking to adults than children. I always preferred listening to grown-up conversations than Barney on TV. And I suppose that kind of exposed me really early on to ideas that I had to wrap my head around.
Yeah.
And very early on, my parents, for whatever reason, recognized that the internet was a thing and that cell phones were a thing. So I got technology really early on. I think I had my first computer when I was 10 or 11 with an internet connection in my room. My siblings showed no interest in that. So I just took it as my own. I got my first cell phone when I was 13, bearing in mind that was 1997. So it was really, really early on. And I've just been exposed to all these new technologies from a young age and kind of adapted to them. Frustratingly, I never really delved deep enough into anything. I kind of set myself to be a generalist rather than a specialist. I wish I could code better than I can, but, you know, that's how it goes. That was my upbringing.
And you had on this computer that you had with the internet connection when you were
yes.
a kid, you tried your hand at hacking at one point.
I mean, what was I thinking? I couldn't be a nicer guy. It doesn't work that way. So, yeah, I discovered MIRC. And for those of you who are older than or younger than me, MIRC is kind of like WhatsApp. But from 20 years ago, and everyone was anonymous, and you could kind of join these chat rooms with various interests. Actually, it was like a Reddit as well. So I joined Merck and discovered a couple of people, taught myself how to code HTML, and then built a website and figured, hey, what's the next thing? And one of the guys I'd made friends with on MIRC decided to help me break into some dude's computer. And back then it was relatively simple. There were no firewalls. There was no password protection.
Yeah.
And we ended up after a couple of days inside of this guy's computer. I mean, I don't even know who the guy was or where it was. And once we were in, this other dude and I realized, what the hell are we going to do now? And back then, it's not like there was anything particularly interesting on these computers. Like, porn wasn't even a thing. So if we wanted to blackmail this guy, how on earth would we have done that? So we realized that this wasn't really up for us. We deleted our pathways into this guy's computer, and that was the first and last hack I'd ever performed.
Right. Fascinating. Fascinating.
Yeah.
Nick, another section of the book I really loved was your decision, and I forget when this was, but all by yourself, you decided to fly off to Scotland to attend, what was it, a G7 meeting?
It was the G8 summit back then.
G8 summit, okay.
Yes.
What on earth possessed you to do that?
Going to Grahamstown, it's really simple to become caught up in the principle of save the world and do better, and everything is very idealistic. And I was sitting in Diggs, and we had a TV, and I was watching CNN because I was studying journalism. Obviously, I was watching CNN. And Bob Geldof popped onto the screen, and sitting next to him, I think at the time, was Bono. And I don't know if, Duncan, if you allow swearing on this show.
We're a clean podcast, but you're welcome to swear.
Clean,
and
that's great. I'll stick to clean. Okay. And Bob Geldof got on live on CNN and started swearing at the camera, and it was live. I mean, this is unheard of, that someone was swearing on one of the most prestigious news platforms, and he was just imploring people to do more, to get off their backsides and engage in the world. And I looked at the screen and I was like, hell, he's right. I got to go and do this. And I got it in my head that I should fly to Edinburgh for the G8 summit. And instead of having a 21st birthday, I decided to cash out the money and use that money to go and fund my trip. And I got on a plane about 2 weeks later with my film camera. That's how long ago we're talking about, that journalists were still using film cameras. And I went and shot roll and got chased around by riot police with protesters dressed as clowns, and learned that it's not really that easy to be a freelance journalist when no one knows your name and no one's pre-bought anything that you produce. So I ended up going home with all my money spent and no one to buy my product.
You arrived there, though, and you immediately spent most of your money on a hotel you couldn't afford.
Yeah. That was good times. I mean, talk about being wet behind the ears. I mean, I didn't even plan ahead to figure out where I would go. I literally just landed and went, I'll find somewhere to stay, and ended up at a pub and then got a bit late, and there was nowhere to stay. So I think I spent half my money for the week on one hotel room and had to budget the rest of it accordingly.
In hindsight, would you do it again?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, the photos that I've got, no one bought them, but they're still some of my prized possessions. Yeah. And I mean, it's a really liberating experience, having gone from under your parents' wing and 18 at a Catholic school to 20 on your own.
Getting chased by riot police.
Exactly. I mean, you don't really know what it's about until you're in the thick of it. And no point was I in real harm, but you don't know what you don't know until you're there experiencing it.
Yeah, for sure. So, Nick, let's talk about your career, although I know the word career probably isn't the right one to use. What did you make of your time at the FM? You were editing a campus magazine supplement with the aim, I think, to nurture younger readers into the FM. Because, let's be honest, one of the FM's biggest problems was that its audience was, on average, pretty old.
They were literally dying.
Yeah. What do you remember of that experience? I know you started a gadgets blog called Nudget while you were there as well.
Yes. So I remember that period being quite a baptism of fire for me. I think, looking back, one thing that your degree, and I think this applies to any formal education, what it doesn't teach you is what it's really like. What is it really like on the floor of a bank? What is it really like trading stocks every day? What's it really like in a newsroom? You don't know until you're actually there. And I have always been pretty good at selling my ability to learn and getting jobs that are way beyond my capabilities. And I definitely think that's what I did at FM. So what I remember very distinctly about editing this this magazine was that I was in way over my head. And I mean, that was a good thing. I like the idea. I call it living at the forefront of incompetence. So you are completely incompetent until you educate yourself, and then you're not. So that's kind of what I remember about FM. I do remember them being frustratingly slow to adopt digital. I remember the layout of magazines being quite old school and interesting, but old school. I also remember the content being very stale for me personally. I really struggled reporting on the same things week in and week out to do with financial markets. But I do also remember that it's an interesting place to be, having deadlines every week and every month, and having to hit those deadlines. Like, journalists are a very unique breed of human who dedicates themselves to doing this thankless task for very little pay. And probably at that time was the moment I realized that it wasn't for me, being a traditional journalist in the sense of hitting a deadline and being paid to write words. And very quickly, I tried to shift in Business Day and Financial Mail towards helping them with online and building out the websites and blogs and creating content that was a bit more dynamic. But hitting the resistance in that space led me to starting up this tech gadget blog on the side with two colleagues at Avusa at the time. And we built it out and started doing it on the side.
Right, and you eventually sold it to Avusa for a small sum.
We did. For a very small sum, and it was more of a Avusa won't sue us if we just sell it to them for this very small sum, because we had built this tech gadget blog in work hours, kind of in our lunch hours, but still in our work hours, which technically meant that they owned it.
Right.
And we had been profiting off it through ads and getting sponsored gadgets to publish. And we had arranged, luckily, instead of getting fired or sued, to just flip it over to them for a very small sum and walk on without being too pissed off with anyone.
Right.
And I think that was them being quite polite and us being quite naive. But regardless, I think that was kind of a tipping point for me to go, actually, this whole outdated media industry is way too slow for me.
Yeah.
And if they can't even let me just run a blog, then I'm out.
Right.
And that was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back.
So you then moved to the Mail and Guardian, brought in by V, if I remember correctly, who was one of your lecturers at Rhodes. You don't mention V's name in the book, so I won't do so here. But the two of you, who had become good friends, I think, would spend many years in business together. But you eventually had a huge falling out after you clashed about a later venture. But tell us first about the M&G gig. What attracted you to the M&G at the time?
So mainly working with V and Matt Buckland attracted me, and they were definitely the most progressive online team and mobile team basically on the continent at the time. I mean, Mail and Guardian's got a long history of being innovative in the digital space. They were the very first online news portal on the continent. And I mean, that's just, who could turn down that? They've also got this incredible reputation in media, generally speaking, and I felt like it was a good place for me to learn. My career has been undertoned by fake it till you make it, and I wanted to stop faking it for a while and actually go somewhere where I could learn. I also identified mobile as quite a big trend that I wanted to embed myself into, and the position available at Mail and Guardian was the head of mobile, which at that time no one really knew what that meant. So V and I kind of carved that out for me, and I dove in headfirst while M&G was relaunching their website. I can't even remember when this was, 2006 or 2007. In that time. And V, myself and Matt worked tirelessly for 5 months rebuilding that website.
Right. And I recall from the book that it was pretty intense work. You were reworking databases, and it was pretty intense.
Yes.
Stuff. Yeah. But what happened
yes,
next?
You, I mean...
Yeah.
No, go ahead.
Sorry, what happened next? You left the M&G eventually to join Zupi, which was an online video provider, if I recall.
Yes. So at this time, Web 2.0 was kicking in quite heavily around the world, and South Africa was no different. So we had lots of startups popping up. There still wasn't a massive VC or venture capital environment, so the startups were few and far between. But talent was even more hard to come by. I think I was quite swept up in the whole movement of getting involved in a startup and trying to make something my own. And I had been speaking to Jason Elk, who was the CEO at Zupi, for a couple of months trying to get them to host Mail and Guardian's video content. And throughout this process, all happening over GChat, because back then Google Chat was the thing, Jason kind of took a liking to me and asked if I would want to join them and head up their Joburg division of Zupi, and very quickly offered me double my salary, and very quickly I was money struck and took it, and not really thinking about the repercussions of a decision like that, especially with the network that I'd built with Matt and V. I kind of just approached Matt and said, hey dude, so kind of I'm leaving. And he had just dealt with V resigning a week or two before,
right,
to go off to Vodacom, and Matt absolutely lost his nut, and I've never been scolded, and I felt like I was a kid being scolded by a boss like that before or since. So yeah, I walked in to explain to Matt that I had taken a job at Zupi, and yeah, he lost it, and understandably, we just launched a new website, and he was building a team around myself and V, and and we just both left right from under him.
Right.
And he was livid. I've never been shouted at like that. And I think if you've worked with Matt, you probably know the kind of scolding that I'm talking about. But Matt is an extremely accomplished entrepreneur who gets done what needs to get done and is very direct. So if you kind of screw with that vision of what he's looking for, he's not polite about how you're doing that. And, you know, there's something to be respected about that, but I left quite shell-shocked. Although I did leave thinking, oh, well, obviously, I mean, now I'm justified in my silly move. And, I mean, in hindsight, it was a crazy move. I was working at basically the most esteemed online media platform on the continent, and I left to join a startup. But I think that that just speaks to my desire to want to do young, fresh, innovative things at young businesses. And so off I went to Zoopy.
Did you chat to Matt again later, or do you speak to him?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, Matt and I, we're friends, and we worked together later on at Motribe. And, yeah, very happy to still engage with Matt. I mean, I think you just got to know how some people are. And, you know, that's how Matt expressed his sadness and disappointment, was through loud noises.
Okay, so V had moved onto Vodacom, and he eventually brought you across. You left Zoopy. That must have been a bit of a culture shock for you, right?
You know, it should have been, but I think V had been at Vodacom for the 6 months that I was, or I lie, a little bit longer, the 10 months that I was at Zoopy. And he had kind of carved out a very effective way for us to avoid the corporate rubbish that is inside of Vodacom. Little tricks like, everyone's calendar at Vodacom is public, so you can book anyone into a meeting at any time. What V and I would do is just book our own calendars. He would book mine and I would book his, and then we'd be in meetings all day and we would never be in a meeting. So little tricks like that. We also had our budget carved out, and we had built a little area in a dark corner of Vodacom that no one would really bother us. So we were building innovative stuff inside of a business that didn't really care about that innovation, save for the fact to say that they were doing it. So we kind of were just left to our own devices until budget time. And when budget time came around, we had to justify our spend and justify our existence. It's one of those, it's kind of, everyone who's ever worked in a corporate understands the idea that if you don't spend the budget you've been given, you're given less budget the following quarter. So we would go through those processes and just see where we could, in an interesting way, spend our budget so we could justify getting more of it.
Yeah, so, but it must have been a bit frustrating working in such a giant organization, trying to do innovative things when the revenue you were producing was negligible compared to the big beast that is Vodacom voice revenue, for example.
Absolutely. I mean, many years later, I'd come to understand that this is the disruptive model that big corporates suffer to understand, that yes, in the short term, you're earning a little bit of revenue on the innovation you're developing, but in the long term, that's the disruption you need to shift your business away from where it is. And it's exactly what we went through at Vodacom. We were building a social network for them on feature phones. If you don't know what a feature phone is and you're listening to this, go and Google it and you'll find some pictures of old Nokias. And we had managed to get nearly 2 million users, 1.8 million users on a platform that would actually become Foursquare when Foursquare launched. It was a location-based platform where users could engage with one another called The Grid. And the summary of my corporate frustration was V and I worked out that our two-year budget was basically 8 hours of revenue for Vodacom through their voice side. And like, when you're building something and you're dedicating 15 hours a day to it, and you realize that in 10 hours your parent company earned more money, it's just heartbreaking. It gives you a real lust for what you're doing. And we decided there and then that we were tired of making rich people richer and our bosses look good. So we started building something new.
Yeah, but you also built an online game called Legends of Echo.
Yes.
What was that? Where did that come from?
So that came out of the technology we'd actually built at the grid, basically the location-based mapping that we'd built. And inside of Vodacom, we were obviously looking to come up with new and innovative ways to make money for them. So we decided to look at World of Warcraft, which was absolutely exploding at the time. And we built ourselves, and bear with me here, a massively multiplayer online location-based mobile game. And what that meant was you could become a character, use your phone, and fight other characters in real time within your location and earn money doing that. So the very sickening Vodacom revenue model was every time you fired your weapon, we would deduct airtime from you. And, I mean, people loved it. We had 5,000 users in the first month, and the revenue was many, many multiples of the number of users. I mean, we were making 60 to 100,000 rand a month on 5,000 users.
Incredible.
It was insane. But that just wasn't fast enough or big enough for the scale that Vodacom operates at, and they just didn't really care about it.
So, as you mentioned, it was while you were at Vodacom that the idea for MoTribe came about. What was MoTribe?
Yes. MoTribe was a social network builder for mobile devices. So there were many competitors back in the day on desktop, one of them being Ning, N-I-N-G. Basically, if you liked Facebook, great. Why don't you build your own Facebook using MoTribe? And we built it so that you could do that all using a feature phone because we were obviously embedded in the emerging markets. So we targeted emerging markets customers who had feature phones at the time. So you could register on our mobile website, or back then it was called a WAP site. WAP. I mean, crazy.
Horrible
right?
name.
Horrible name. And you could then register an account, start your own little social network for your church group or your football team or your neighborhood, and then you could ask people to join your little website. So, for example, motribe.com/nextfootballteam, and people would go there and sign up to your little social network.
So you, it was around this time that you upped and moved down to Cape Town. You got seed money from Justin Stanford of 4DI Capital, but it was tough going. You were chasing venture capitalists probably too hard. You were getting turned down constantly. It sounds like it was a really tough time in your life personally and professionally.
Yes, it was. And the funny thing is, at the time, I was a frog in boiling water. Like, it didn't feel tough because we were one of the first Silicon Cape startups to be built around that brand. When Silicon Cape launched, V and I were actually at the launch off the back of Vodacom's funding. And MoTribe in Cape Town. This is cool. Let's see who's out there. And we had built a prototype of MoTribe called Emo Friends, which was an emo kids network. And it exploded. We got like 20,000 users in a couple of months, all organically and all virally. And we decided to move to Cape Town to build this business because that's where our VC firm was and it was a requirement for them. Mm-hmm. And very quickly, we started to build a platform that was working, and we knew how to spend money, having just done that at Vodacom, on ads to acquire customers. It was the same customer demographic as the grid, our Vodacom customer base, and we knew all the tricks, and we knew the people in the industry. So the platform gained traction really quickly, and we decided that in typical Silicon Valley fashion, it was everything or nothing. There was no middle ground. So we should raise more money than we had at 4DI. We should grow bigger. We should hire more staff. We should get bigger offices. We should open offices across the world. And actually, what we just needed to do was create a product that was sticky and make money from it. Two very important things when you're building a tech startup.
Yeah.
And many startup founders will tell you that it's good to have a co-founder pair because when one of you is out raising money, it's basically 80% of your time. You cannot raise money full-time and run a business. It's just too difficult. And we were pretty understaffed for what we were trying to do. And me being out on the road trying to raise funding and having some conflict with V and our investors kind of not really in agreement with the idea of going out and raising more funding, and they were right, it made it all quite a difficult time. And at that point in my life, being young and naive, I believed that the only way to run a startup was to work yourself into oblivion. 18-hour days, really bad health, mm-hmm. No exercise, bad food. And it's just not a sustainable way to do anything, I would later learn.
Yeah. Indeed, your health suffered, and I think you deal with that in an entire chapter in the book. But you eventually fell out with V. What happened? How did Mo Tribe come apart at the seams, and how did your relationship with V come undone?
It's a great question, and one that I actually have never dealt with prior to writing the book publicly, and this is the first time I'll be talking about it. So startups are a complex beast, and the head of the beast is the founders, and V and I had a very complex interpersonal relationship, one that started with him in a position of power always. He was always my lecturer or my boss or my mentor, and we over time became friends, and at MoTribe, very cleanly and very clearly and very quickly, the partnership became equal. So I became the CEO and V became the CTO, and very quickly that started to complicate things, purely because this was both of our first startup. We had raised venture capital, and it was kind of a very pressurizing time to exist in the world. And the first year was all hunky-dory because we signed customers and we had adoption on our platform. And I think we made like 3 million rand in revenue in the first year, but not through our core platform, through selling the platform to big corporates. So now you've got this very complicated situation where our platform is telling us to be one thing. The founders want it to be something else. The CEO is young and untested. The CTO is older and more experienced, but also untested in a startup, and the conflict is just rife. I mean, you can't write this stuff. Like, it's just very real and complicated politics.
Yeah.
Managing your investors, your co-founders, your employees, your revenue, your cash flow. And I think as a naive 25-year-old, I did some things that just aren't sustainable as a startup founder. I took pay cuts as we needed cash flow. Our investors rightfully wouldn't just plow money into the business, and we didn't want to dilute our equity too much. V has a family and didn't feel like it was appropriate to take a pay cut at the time, which in hindsight I accepted but should never have, because co-founders, like, startup is about risk. If you're not willing to take the risk and eat the dirt, then you shouldn't be in a startup. You should be in a formal corporate environment where you can get a salary. And over time, we just realized that there was a problem. So we started looking for revenue wherever we could. We started looking for partnerships, and that led us to working with Mixit. Mixit at the time was the biggest social network in the country, and expanding, and they had also just sold to Alan Knott Craig Jr. and his investment company World of Avatar.
Yeah.
So we started engaging with Alan again. The first time, a little side anecdote, the first time we engaged with Alan, he came to our office, quote-unquote office, which was my house and our dining room, and offered us in the region of 60 million rand to buy the business. And this was about 12 months in to MoTribe, and we scoffed and turned it down. Now, whether that offer was genuine or not, only Alan will know, or whether it was a mind game he was trying to play with us, who can tell? But we turned it down regardless. And I think looking back, that was probably a big, big mistake. And lesson for anyone listening who's starting their business, pick a number. If anyone ever offers you that number for your business, sell.
Mm-hmm.
Sell. Because you can take that money and build another business. Just sell. So these sorts of things, like not selling, making decisions as a CEO, conflict with your CTO, those all build up to something. And after working with Mixit, we realized that there was something to be had there, and we could kind of pivot a little bit of our business into building stuff on Mixit. And without realizing it, V and Mixit got closer than I had anticipated. And one day, after having come back from a Joburg trip where I'd signed a few clients and we'd become break-even or profitable, V sat me down and said, listen, I've sold the business, and the deal's really simple. You're not part of it. Either you agree or I quit, and I'm going to keep my equity, and good luck to you. I'm out.
That must have shocked you.
It floored me. I literally thought that he was joking. So I was like, oh, that's really funny. Cool. Could we get back to my meeting? And he was like, no, but seriously, it's Wednesday now. You've got till Friday. Take Thursday. Figure out what you want to do. And then you have to tell me what's up.
What were you thinking at that point? What was going through your head?
I was in utter disbelief. I kind of the thing that I remember very vividly was that he didn't have it in him to look me in the eye. He was looking down at his mug, staring at the coffee in it, and clearly understood that something that had happened had not been particularly above board. And look, I'm going to put a big caveat on the story. Looking back in hindsight, what was done was absolutely the correct move, but absolutely done in the worst possible way.
Right.
So we should have been looking to sell Motribe. We should have been looking for outs because the platform was fundamentally broken, and I was too naive and egotistical to realize that, and that I should have started to look for outs. Unfortunately, the way that it was done was behind my back and without my knowledge or insight. And so what had happened was V and Alan had negotiated an exit for myself and our investors against either of us knowing to do this and against his mandates. The CEO is mandated in a business to sell the business, not the CTO. So there are a lot of complicated legal issues there, which I chose to not follow through because I was broke. Okay. And you need money to sue people. But ultimately, 4DI kind of kicked in, and Justin and his partners were very responsible adults and said to me, look, this is what's happening. There is an exit on the table. Everyone will make money. Let's just take this. And without being in the same room, they insisted that I should vote for this because V had, and V should vote for it because I had, and then they voted for the deal, and then it was done. At least so I thought. Once the deal was done, it was a very quick transition of me out and mix it in, and mix it, whether it was Alan or his minions who decided to stop paying me my salary or quote-unquote conveniently delay paying me my salary until the deal was up. They then started renegotiating the deal while I was under duress, and that almost exploded the whole thing. But ultimately, we came to a deal that worked for everyone, and I sold, and that was the end of that.
You explain in the book about a very uncomfortable meeting you had with Alan, not Craig Jr. I think in the Winelands, if I remember.
Yes, it was at Spear.
Spear, yeah. Tell us about that meeting.
So at this point, I was still a little bit naive and still thinking that there was a way to salvage this, and I had leverage. And I was so shell-shocked that I thought that the BATNA sat with me, and there was no BATNA. There was no alternative for me. Hmm. So I decided to phone Alan and drive out to Stellenbosch. I mean, this is the guts of the guy.
Yeah.
He is taking my company from under me, and he didn't even come to me. I had to drive to him.
Yeah.
So I drove to Spear Wine Farm and sat with Alan and tried to renegotiate the price or the terms. And it was in that meeting that I understood that V had exposed our books to Mixit, and our runway and our pipeline and our technology backend. So I had no leverage. I had nothing to lean on to get a different deal, because they had all the insights that they needed to value our business. And I mean, valuing a business is not as straightforward as looking at the numbers, but when you have all the numbers, there's nothing else to really talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And Alan laid out what the deal was and then sat and waited for me to say something. And I sat and thought about something to say for a good 5 or 6 minutes in absolute silence. And Alan just took out his phone, and I guess he played on it for a while on Mixit, I hope. And then I was like, cool. So that's that then. Thanks, Alan. Got up and walked away. And that was it.
That must have been one hell of a tough meeting.
Oh, man. I mean, the whole period was about 2 months from beginning to end. And in that time, I don't remember feeling more depressed, physically ill, uncomfortable, confused than ever before or again.
Yeah.
And it's a good thing to go through as a founder, because you realize that once it's over, you come out okay.
Yeah,
and these
yeah.
things are not life and death. Businesses are not life and death. Some businesses are, don't get me wrong, if you're saving lives, great. But when it's a social network or, you know, the sock company I run now, it's not life and death. And you feel like it is, but you have to go through those lessons to learn that it's not.
And you went into a pretty dark place after the demise of, or the sale of Motribe. You you talk about how you lay around in your flat in your underpants for weeks on end. you became pretty depressed about the whole thing. How did you pull out of that?
So I was extremely depressed, a very real dark depression. I don't know how my partner dealt with me for 3 months. And literally just sitting on the couch watching DSTV for 8 hours a day, playing with my newly acquired dog. And I think that ultimately the thing that gets me out of it is the idea that this is what I do. I build stuff, and failure isn't really avoidable. If you're building things, the only way to build things is to fail. And it's kind of the genesis of my thinking around the book that I've written, that failure isn't failure if you've learned something. If you're learning lessons throughout these hardships, then what you're acquiring is knowledge, and you're acquiring a better way to do things. So I decided that the only way to get up and out of this depression was to build something new. Mm-hmm. And I started thinking of new things to build. And I literally made lists, spoke to people. In the book, I list some of the things that I tried to build, things like Zomato before Zomato launched, to Africa porn networks, you name it. I thought, could this work? And, you know, that kind of got my creative juices flowing again.
Great stuff. So out of interest, have you spoken to V and even to Alan again post-Motoride? Have you tried to patch things up? Has there been any communication between you, or is there still bad blood?
Alan, absolutely no bad blood, but absolutely no patching up or conversations post-acquisition. He's building what he's building, yeah, and I'm building what I'm building, and that's fine.
Okay.
I made a concerted effort to chat with him a year after the whole thing had happened, and we kind of cleared some stuff up. It will never be the same, and I think that's how life is supposed to be. I think social networks make us think that we have to be friends with everyone forever because we're friends with them on Facebook, and I just don't subscribe to that mantra. So V and I, we bump into each other at the airport, and it's all good, and there's no bad blood. Whether that remains to be true after the book is read and published, who knows?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, there's no bad blood. I think it's been a few years since this all happened, and I think that as you get older, you realize that V did the best that he could do. I don't think that his intent was to harm me personally, but he didn't know what else to do. And I think I can recognize that feeling, and I understand it now. I didn't understand it for the 2 or 3 years after it happened. But yeah, there's no hard feelings, and from my side, there's no bad blood.
Okay, so if he was to if he reads the book and gives you a call and said, let's go for a coffee, you'd say yes.
Absolutely, yeah.
Great stuff. Well, V, if you're listening, give Nick a call. I must apologize, Nick. That's about as far as I have got into the book. I'm hoping to finish the rest of it this week, but I have some idea of what happened next. But take us through it. What happened after Motoribe? I think there was a consulting company that you got involved with, and then you started Nick Socks after that.
Correct. So I talk quite honestly about being lost and hopeless and needing a grown-up to help me through the tough times after Motoribe. And I started a consulting firm called Forefront Africa, using the skills that I'd acquired at Motoribe in mobile and on the African continent, negotiating with mobile network operators. I started it with a lady that I'd met at Mixit at the time and at Vodacom when I worked there. And her and I built up a consulting firm that basically took businesses from around the world into the African continent through the mobile networks in Kenya, Ghana, Nigeria. Absolutely hated it. I am not a careered consultant, and I have no intention of helping big businesses make more money. So we eventually sold that business to Imperial Logistics, which was supposed to be on a 3-year earnout, but I hated Imperial more than I hated the idea of working there. The men that are in that business are tough to work with and very dictatorial on their methodologies, and I just wasn't cut out for it. So rather than be subjected to 3 years of pain and suffering, I decided to literally give the shares back to my partner, and she stuck it out and actually had a really good exit with them. So proud of her for doing that. And in the interim between those two businesses, Motoribe and Forefront Africa, I started a sock company, which is still running today. It's now called NickHarry.com, where we sell socks, T-shirts, and underwear. That business was the one I think that helped me really kick into the new entrepreneurial outlook that I have now.
Yeah.
That, you know, you can have fun and you can be honest and you can be real. And that business is now alive and where it is now.
Why socks?
Why not? No, that's a terrible answer. the truth is, it was very clear and calculated. I wanted to get into e-commerce. I wanted to do something that wasn't too expensive in terms of capital. Mm-hmm. So, you know, bringing cars in and selling cars would have been heavy on the capital. So I decided to go with the idea of selling a light product that was easy to ship anywhere in the world, that could be made locally, that was on trend. And the trend was indicating that bright, colorful socks were heading to Africa in the coming 3 years when I started in 2012. So I decided to get ahead of the game. And, you know, we manufactured locally. I learned about how you make socks. I learned about e-commerce and decided to build a business in that way. And since then, we've opened 5 retail outlets. We've closed 2 retail outlets because retail's tough.
It is.
And we ship all over the world. We've got 3 stores live in South Africa.
Fantastic. And Nick, more recently you've started a new, I'll call it a news website, I guess, coininsider.com, which focuses on cryptocurrencies and everything that's happening in the crypto world. What was the genesis of that?
Yeah, so I've been interested in cryptocurrency since 2011. The very first email I ever sent was to V, actually, when we were at Motribe. And it was a short email that said, hey, V, we should look into this Bitcoin thing and implement it on the Motribe platform. And we were so busy that he didn't see the email and I never got back to it. I rue that day because at that time, I think that Bitcoin was at $2 or $4.
I hope
Bitcoin.
You bought some.
I did not.
Damn.
I did not. But then in 2013-14, started to re-engage with it and put some money in, and through 2015 and 16 started buying a few more coins, and I decided that it's something that I believe is going to define the next 20 years of technology. So a couple of friends of mine were looking to build Coininsider out, and they didn't have a founder or a CEO to run it with the relevant experience. And, my technology, cryptocurrency, and media experience sort of ticked all the boxes. So I decided that I'd join them and help them build it out. So there we are. Coininsider.com is live. And I do see cryptocurrency and blockchain as a defining technology of our generation. I was too young to really capitalize on the dot-com boom in 2000. But I think that I would kick myself in 20 years if I don't jump onto the blockchain bandwagon.
All right. So I have to ask you then, do you think Bitcoin at its present levels is undervalued?
I think that Bitcoin is going to drop a little bit lower, and I'm buying. I'm buying into the dip, and I'm holding. I'm not a trader. I believe in the platform and the technology, so I think absolutely Bitcoin right now is undervalued. I think that if you can afford it, and even if you can't, you should be buying fractions of Bitcoins just to hold and see where it goes.
Okay.
Great. Bearing in mind, I'm not a financial advisor. Please do not come back and tell me that you bought from because I told you to.
I bought my first bit of Bitcoin a few weeks ago, so I'm also watching it with a great deal of interest.
Welcome.
But Nick, as we move to wrap up the podcast, let me ask you this. Let's say there's a youngster listening to the show. Perhaps they're still in school or university. Perhaps they're wondering if they should start their own business rather than going to corporate. What would you say are the top 3 things that they should keep in mind? Because entrepreneurship isn't for everyone, right?
No, I think the important belief that I hold is that not everyone is meant to be an entrepreneur. And the real truth is this stuff is really hard. There are extremes that you deal with that you're not prepared for. A lot of people I know of think that you're going to start your own business and get more time out of your day, and you'll own your time and you'll be able to pay yourself. And all those things are just not true. You have less time, you have less money, you pay your staff first, you pay your suppliers second. So the 3 things that I would say to someone wanting to start their own business is start as soon as you can. Mm-hmm. If you really, really want to do this, start today. There is no good reason to wait. You keep thinking that there's a good reason. You think that it's going to be better next week. You think your idea is going to get more developed. It's not. Just start today. The best way to test your idea is to get people using your idea. So don't be precious of your ideas. Start today. The second one is stop worrying about someone stealing your idea. No one is trying to steal your idea. If it was a billion-dollar idea, someone is already doing it, and you need to do it better than them. There is nothing unique about what you're doing. The only difference between you and someone else is how you execute your idea. Execution is everything. Facebook was not the first social network. Google was not the first social search engine. And in fairness, Bitcoin was not the first digital currency. So do not be shy. Just put your idea out there and get it going. And the second thing is, don't spend too much money on your idea. You need to build the minimum viable version of your product. And if you haven't, you should go and read Eric Ries's book, The Lean Startup, because he is a big proponent of that. Try and get the simplest, cheapest version of your product out there and use people using it. So don't plow your capital in. Don't spend R1 million just building something before a user even sees it. Spend as little as you can, get it into the market, and just build. It's the whole premise of my book is just do.
Just do
stuff. Just do stuff. And I'm going to add a fourth one on there just for kicks. Forget about worrying about failure. Failure is absolutely inevitable. 85% of businesses fail within the first 18 months. You are going to fail. But once you've done it once, you'll know what failure feels like, you'll survive, and then you'll want to do it again. So just get out there and forget about failure.
Great advice. Lastly, Nick, writing a book is obviously a great opportunity for reflection. Big regrets? Any big regrets looking back?
I hate to say this because it sounds so cheesy, but my biggest regret is that I didn't do more earlier. Mm-hmm. I wish that I'd started more businesses when I was younger. I wish that I'd taken more risks. I wish that I had built things that really could have made a dent in the universe when I was really, really, really young, so that I could have gotten as many failures out of the way as possible. There's lots of research coming out now statistically that entrepreneurs over the age of 40 are more successful than entrepreneurs under the age of 40. And I believe firmly that that's because the older people are starting things younger and failing quicker. Mm-hmm. So I wish that I'd failed more. That's my one regret. Otherwise, everything I've done, I do not regret. I absolutely am happy with the things that I've done.
Nick, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting to you. Do Fail, Learn, Repeat by Nick Haralambos is available at all good bookstores around the country. I presume there's a Kindle version too?
It is on Amazon, and if you'd like a signed copy, you can go to my website, nickharalambos.com, and order one there, and I will sign and ship it to you.
Fantastic. I look forward to the follow-up to this book, and may it be filled with tales of great success. Thanks for sharing your insights with Tech Central today.
Thanks for having me, Duncan.
Absolute pleasure.